Canadian television nerds. My name is Anthony Marco, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, Adam Barkin. Having spent the last many years as a writer and producer on Rookie Blue, Remedy, and Flashpoint, Adam Barkin's name will once more be splashed across the screen this summer in the new space series Killjoys. Killjoys follows a trio of reclamation agents as they chase deadly warrens throughout the Quad, a distant planetary system on the brink of a bloody class war. The three Killjoys form a highly accomplished team of bounty hunters, each with distinct and valuable specialties to offer as they navigate the culturally rich, politically complex, and economically polarized worlds of the Quad. We'll talk about this, some stories from previous shows he's worked on, and a revenge plot against Romper Room during my discussion with Adam Barkin. So starting up within the next couple days, everyone who is a sci-fi fan is going to be able to see this show called Killjoys. Now, Killjoys, being a guy from Hamilton, I remember a band called the Killjoys from the 90s. This isn't about power pop or anything like that.
No, although there is some power pop on the soundtrack, I'm pretty sure. So okay, at least you'll get that.
That's cool. So what's Killjoys all about?
Well, Killjoys, the basic premise of it, created by Michelle Lavretta, is three bounty hunters in space, kicking ass and being cool. That was kind of the basic premise that I remember first hearing about. And I'm just going, yeah, sign me up. Where do we go?
And I'm guessing when you're doing, there are a lot of, if there's one thing that Canadians seem to be picking up on now, it's sci-fi. Mm-hmm. For a long time, I think we were doing cop shows. Mm-hmm. Then we were doing medical shows, and all the way along we were doing sci-fi. But it seems like now the sci-fi shows seem to last for a period of time, and it seems like we're building up these sci-fi shows. How do you, when you sit down to make a sci-fi show, how do you play with the tropes and still distinguish yourself from the other sci-fi that have came for the past 50 or 75 years?
Sure, good question. I mean, honestly, when we sat down to do the show, and it was the first time, although I've been a huge genre and sci-fi fan all my life, this was the first chance I got to actually do a show with spaceships. So it was kind of new to me. In the end, you kind of do it exactly the way you do every other show, which is you start with, what's our world? You know, what are our characters? You certainly very quickly realize, okay, obviously people have been down this path before. So there's usually at least one or two people in the room who know those shows pretty well. And the trick, of course, is it's good to know what other people have done. At the same time, you don't want to be so knowledgeable that it hamstrings you from, you know, trotting a similar territory.
Right.
So on Killjoys, you know, we certainly had lots of people in the room who were Star Trek fans and who were Firefly fans and who were Stargate fans. But not all of us, and not everybody had the exact same interests. And, you know, to be honest, because the other, I'd say, important aspect of Killjoys is a broader sweep and scope, a kind of epic story about what's going on in this interplanetary system, which involves politics and is kind of more serialized in nature. We looked beyond sci-fi and looked more towards shows like Game of Thrones, and, you know, Rome, and those sorts of sweeping epics to also inform us as to where the show would go.
So are we talking about essentially a series, season-long arc, as opposed to, I mean, probably some episodic stuff in there, but more based on the long arc as opposed to a procedural, let's say?
No, to be honest, it's my all-time favorite TV format, which is kind of right in the middle. I think, you know, it was kind of, you know, in a lot of ways pioneered and perfected by X-Files, although I think Joss Whedon was also an important guy in that, to create the episodic show with really strong threads that guide you through. I remember in X-Files they used to call it, you know, there's the case episodes and the mythology episodes.
Right.
But when you really go back and look at them, when X-Files was firing on all cylinders, it was doing both.
Right.
And that's, you know, I think what we aspired to definitely on Killjoys was, you know, case of the weeks are fun. And one of the things that I love about television that makes it different from movies is that you have this kind of episodic, almost short story ability to tell these little close-ended stories. And that's really exciting. And yet at the same time, these are people with ongoing lives, and you want to be able to explore that. And then, yes, there is this larger arc story that also plays out over it. So what we were really trying to do was balance all of them so that a person could tune in to episode 3 or 4 and not feel lost. But at the same time, if they stick with it, feel like, oh, good, I'm also getting a continuity to the whole mythology.
Sure. Now, because, I mean, I'm a huge sci-fi fan myself. Mm-hmm. If there's one genre that has opened itself up to a real breadth of tone across the board, it's been sci-fi. I mean, there is wacky, stupid, funny sci-fi, and there is deadly serious sci-fi. Mm-hmm. When you sit down with a group of writers and you're thinking to yourself, all of the examples that you mentioned earlier in terms of tone, where do you think Killjoys happens to fall?
Well, I think, again, because it really is like every other show, is that if you've got a strong showrunner, yeah, the tone flows from them. And, you know, in Michelle, you couldn't get stronger. And so her voice and tone was so clear right from the beginning, and we all just kind of then followed its lead. And so anybody who's watched Lost Girl, mm-hmm, you know, right from the beginning, knows there's that tone, which is this really brilliant balance of, you know, there's a real seriousness and a real emotional depth, but leavened with a really great knowing kind of humor that kind of keeps it all moving and crackling. You know, like Michelle's written some of the best lines I've ever seen in a script and had the pleasure of working on, and she's also, you know, moved me deeply. So I would say, you know, what we're going for in terms of that is that hopefully that mix of fun and light at times, and then catching you off guard with real emotional truth.
And sci-fi fans seem to love the idea that they're inside on something.
Exactly. Absolutely.
they like the, you know, the little inside Easter egg jokes from one episode to the next, or from one season to the next. And
yeah, and so do we, right? Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Everybody in the room, I mean, you had a lot of heavy hitters. You had Aaron Martin and Emily Andrus and Jeremy Boxen, amongst others, are, you know, all people who are all big fans of that genre and of that world. So we all kind of wanted to create the same thing.
It seems like more and more shows now are moving to the 10 episode season, the 13 episode season.
Yeah.
Is there liberations as well as constrictions in that? Because I'm thinking, like, the era that I grew up in, it was a 22 to a 26 episode season when you talked about, mm-hmm, a television season. And before me, it was even longer than that. It used to go 35 episodes. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. What I think of, though, is 10 episodes, it's sometimes hard to wait an entire year after 10 episodes.
Right.
So, I mean, to draw a narrative together in 10 episodes, not only to draw it together, which is fantastic, but then to say, now you have to wait for 40 weeks or so.
Yeah. Oh, I hear you. I mean, it's funny. I mean, Canada's always, I think, leaned more towards, at least in the hour-long space, the 13 episode. And it always comes down to economics, right? Right. I mean, it's what we could afford to make, right? So we kind of, I think, were, if not the pioneers, certainly early adopters of the 13-episode format, which obviously now American and American cable, probably for similar economic reasons, kind of figures is the best. I hear you about timing, though, of course, because, you know, when I was a huge Lost fan, even then, and I would get like 22 full episodes, and then the wait of 3 or 4 months seemed excruciating. So, yeah. You know, I hear you. That being said, as an actual writer producer, I am really into the 10 episode format. I think it's even 13. You always end up with episode 7 or 8 where you're like, nah, maybe that one wasn't the strongest because of the way, you know, production goes. You never want to say that at the time, but 10 just feels like you get like, it's almost not quite enough, which is always a good thing, I think, to do. It's like you always want to have just a little bit less time than you wanted because it forces you to really cut all the extraneous stuff.
Well, it comes from a very British model almost. I mean, mm-hmm, one of my favorite shows of all time was The Prisoner. And when Patrick McGoohan conceived of that show, he was only conceiving of 6 episodes. And because it was so popular, they said, we need you to do more. And they went up to 17. But he just said, look, I got nothing after 17.
Well, and the thing is, I know on the British model, I've always felt, you know, along with the fact that, you know, Brits are the best actors in the world. And, and so, you know, hundreds of years of great writing and theater to draw on. That also being said, you know, people would talk about how The Office is the greatest TV show in the world. And it was. It also was only half of the first season of the American Office in terms of amount. So that's not to say there aren't crappy shows that start crappy right from the beginning. But again, when you limit what you have in terms of what, you know, what you're able to make, I find hopefully if you're doing it right, it forces you to just cut out everything but the best stuff you have.
For sure. So as we hope that people are going to be listening to this within a week or so before the premiere, I'm wondering if you can give us either a short, I believe the short or long history part up to you as to kind of the process that's gone on from when you joined up with the team, so to speak, until the point where we're going to be hitting the premiere on June 19th.
Well, I mean, it was kind of a while ago, to be honest, as again with these things in television. So I was pretty much starting the show about a year ago, I guess, time-wise, or maybe a bit earlier, like into March. And so, you know, it was, again, like many other shows, I had read the script, thought it was great, you know, threw my hat in the ring and was lucky enough to get picked by Michelle, and Jeremy was her co-EP, to kind of join them. What we did was we got together for about 10 weeks to break the season and start breaking episodes. Then I kind of went away to write and I had some other stuff to do, but then I was lucky enough to be able to come back during the production, which was, you know, in end of summer and into the fall. And so I was able to produce kind of my own episode, which is always a good thing to be able to do because, you know, as good as you want the script to be, there's nothing quite like the reality of production to force you to, again, change stuff and hopefully make it better as you go.
Sure.
So I was able to be there for production for a few weeks. And then I was back off on some other things. So and then now I've just been kind of waiting to see how it goes. And was really excited to hear about the air date, and then I'll be kind of tuning in with everybody else to see how it looks.
So I'm assuming the episode that you were producing, you've probably seen a final cut on.
I got to see, I was there at a sound mix, yes.
So have you seen final cuts on any of the other episodes yet?
I'm just curious. No, I have not. So, which is, I you know, unless you're obviously, you know, a co-EP or an EP and that's your job, I kind of like it because it'll hopefully, you know, when I get to watch it, there's nothing like watching it fresh, you know, and right in the moment. So, and there was obviously also with a show like this, a heck of a lot of work to be done in post.
Sure.
So even the version that I saw of my episode, I'm sure is going to be different once it hits the air.
Because I'm always curious as to you take a look at the first script and when the realization actually hits the screen, how close that first vision is. Do you think that's a matter of just a matter of years of experience and being able to have a vision in your head, maybe some of the people you're working with, the resources you have, all of that stuff? Or is it maybe a better thing that it completely changes what you originally thought?
It depends. I've been very lucky. Pretty much all the shows I've worked on, I've never had an experience of anything that I was a producer on as well that was like, well, that's not what I meant. And again, being able to produce your own episode, to be there for all the meetings, to kind of work with the departments, to clarify. And, you know, in my experience, departments are never there to go, all right, we know what to do, leave us alone. They're always looking for direction. You know, what did you mean? What should this look like? So, one of the nice things about television and why I think writers are drawn to it is that we do have that sort of authority to be able to, you know, guide the process more than we would say in film. That being said, I've done freelance work where I think the only thing I ended up writing on it was my name. taken other freelancers' work that was great and fine and just wasn't what we needed at the time and completely rewrote it.
For sure.
Because that is also television. So in my experience, certainly on this one, what ended up on the screen, thanks to that team, thanks to, you know, Michelle and Jeremy's work on the script as well, and thanks and especially to Chris Grismer, the director, who's also directed the first few episodes and the finale, I believe, he's just brilliant. And so it's very cool. And as a slight tease, it's kind of actually one of my favorite subgenres in sci-fi more, which is kind of the sci-fi horror episode. So
very cool.
So I'm looking forward to seeing what everybody thinks of that.
So what was some of the sci-fi fanboy ancestry that you brought to this show? Because you said you haven't had a chance to really write for sci-fi before.
Yeah, well, I came in, I remember when I had my interview with Michelle, and I just kind of laid out the bona fides, and she was like, yeah, I haven't watched any of those, so that's fine. That's great. Good, let's have somebody or she hadn't watched them certainly as obsessively as I have. So,
yeah.
I mean, for me and TV, the two big ones were Star Trek, in particular, the next Generation, and right. then Babylon 5 was an absolute and all-time my favorite. I just thought, up until kind of the cable revolution, even, I would have said that was, and I still think it's one of the best shows ever, but I think it was also one of the most unique shows in terms of actually allowing its characters to change and progress, which is something that was exceedingly rare before The Sopranos and Mad Men's, and even now is not a particularly common thing in television. So it was, I think, a real real landmark show.
Well, we talk all the time on the podcast about the idea that, now especially in a sitcom, but it happens in dramas too, that there's a danger in letting characters grow. Because what people love about the show when they first watch it is the basic character types. And, I mean, you take a look at the show like The Big Bang Theory, and those characters haven't changed in 8 years.
Yeah, well, and to be honest, I mean, I think, you know, and I think about this a lot, too. And one of the reasons why I love television, and why, to me, television is a, in my view, a truer representation of life in a day-to-day way, is that it does not promote what I think film by its very nature always does, which is that life is about a series of massive moments of change.
Right.
I think change is obviously an immutable part of life, but to be honest, as I'm now at 40 and kind of looking at who I am and who my friends are and my family, I'm beginning to realize that in a fundamental way, we don't change. Who we are is who we are. And we go through these permutations in life to exploring different facets of ourselves. But ultimately, you know, I think we are often very fundamentally the same people. And I think that's what television gets, you know, whether it's a necessity or whatever. And so I like that. I like the fact that television, you know, I love the fact that Sopranos, for all of its attempts to, as about a man who was trying to change, in the end was no different.
Right.
And that, because that seems very true to me. In a way that film, because it's based completely, in so many ways, the Western model of film is based on the idea that who you are at the beginning is not who you are at the end. That's a great heroic journey.
Right.
It's not, in my experience, the more common human journey.
Sure. I mean, because film has become such it's a compression of narrative, like from anywhere from 2 hours to 200 years sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had that same compression of narrative to a lead character on a show, after one episode or one season, you're done.
Yeah. Well, and as you say, what we fall in love with our characters, and there's that sweet spot you hit, hopefully, in a show where, you know, even a show as kind of, I think, brilliant and revolutionary as Mad Men in terms of confounding your expectations, at the same time you watch that show with certain expectations about what certain people will do given certain stimuli in the same, and I mean that's obviously very true in sitcoms where, you know, you go, oh boy, Sheldon, I know what Sheldon's going to say to this, and then he does, and it's a great feeling of comfort.
Yes.
And I think that's I love that about television.
The example I always use is Homer Simpson, who, if nothing over the years, has gotten dumber.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. I mean, you can see those slight changes, obviously. And you know, with a cartoon, it's weird because they never actually physically change. But it's fascinating to watch television that lasts more than five seasons to see just how people physically change. And yet, I think there are times that when you look at a show, especially if it's either changed showrunners or the showrunner decides to really shake things up. You know, I think the infamous one from my childhood was when Roseanne won the lottery, and it was terrible. It was terrible, and it ruined what was so impressive about the show. And I got from their perspective why they wanted to shake things up, but it was a great example of there's a way you can break it as opposed to just shake it up. So you have to be careful with characters in TV.
Roseanne was such an underrated show in terms of how deadly accurate it took that lower middle class stratum.
Well, yeah, it was to this day. I mean, it's funny. I was having a conversation with a director, Jennifer Lau, a little while ago. We were talking about our love of season two of The Wire, actually, which is, you know, not always a popular opinion, but. And she said, you know, what she struck her about it was that it's a show about the poor white working class, which in a weird way in American TV is just not something you see a lot of.
Yeah.
You don't see a lot of the poor class in general, but in particular, that particular kind of working class was not something she'd used to seeing. And we kind of talked about it and realized, yeah, when was the last example on TV? And it's funny because when you think of one of the greatest sitcoms of all time was obviously The Honeymooners, which was very much about that. But between The Honeymooners and Roseanne, you certainly get a lot more upper middle class stories.
Yeah.
So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, at the time, Roseanne was a huge hit, which was great and very gratifying that she could be so honest. I thought Roseanne was just also, I think back on some episodes where, they wouldn't end a scene with a laugh, where they would go out in dramatic moments. That was just, I think, one of the great, great TV shows of all time.
Yeah, I think it was recognized for being a great comedy in a lot of places and a well-written show. But in terms of its presentation, I think legacy-wise, a lot of people don't necessarily look back on it for just how well it just painted that stratum of society at that time was just mind-blowing.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think there's... again, and probably, while I think Roseanne herself at least was certainly seen at the time and hopefully is still seen as, a great comedic voice and a genius in the way that, I guess Lucille Ball is still remembered. I think, again, it goes beyond that in terms of, what it... I have to believe it's the kind of show as well that just, so long as it can stay, gettable, I have a feeling that I've watched the show since, and it does not feel dated. So I think it's going to continue to have an influence on.
Yeah, you would have had to think there had to have been a showrunner there who said, you know what? No, we're not doing that. No, we're not doing that.
Right? It was her. It was. Yeah. I mean, if you wanted, there's a fantastic article, an older article in the New York Times, in the New Yorker, that was about the struggle. And I mean, it was. Now it sounds like not a pleasant place to necessarily have worked because of the conflicts that they went through from all accounts, even people who weren't her biggest supporters, it was really her saying this is not going to be a standard naggy wife sitcom. Right. This is going to be about my experiences as a lower middle class woman and mother, and she demanded it, and as a result it became something very special.
For sure. At this point in the episode, as our very forced version of segueing, I do what I like to call the beverage update.
Okay.
And the beverage update can be a beverage that you have by you, but even if it's not a beverage you have by you, because we're recording in around the middle of the day and it might be too early for a beverage of choice, if you don't have anything exciting by you and you wish to talk about a beverage that you might be enjoying later, you could do that as well. Because indeed, I'm only now drinking tap water, but I can tell you my beverage of choice for later is a bottle I just picked up at the LCBO, which is our liquor store, of W.L. Weller bourbon, a 12-year bourbon. So.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
Yes.
That sounds very nice. Well, later on, right now I'm drinking a lovely coffee, which is what, as a writer, I drink all from... from sun up till about 5.
Is it artisanal?
It is a espresso based coffee from I'm in Whitby, but we have a really fantastic, believe it or not, Portuguese bakery here that serves great coffee. So I'm still drinking that. Later on, my summer drink of choice these days is Jack Daniels makes a honeyed, it's kind of almost like Drambuie Jack Daniels.
So I've got a bottle here.
Well, you take that, take about a third of that, and then one part that to two parts lemonade.
Okay.
And drink that all night, and you'll feel great. So that is kind of my easy summer drink of choice.
I remember my first Jack Daniels mixed drink used to be the Applejack.
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a big whiskey fan. I actually like Jack Daniels just straight as well.
Yes,
always
same
nice. But over the, in the summer, that's what I drink by the pool.
Got about 60 different bourbons behind me. I've been down to Kentucky a couple times, and I love my bourbon.
Oh, that's
great.
I've
been to the distillery. Yes. And neat is the way to go.
I'm a wimp. I like it on the rocks. I do.
Yeah. Just to kind of to jump back away from Killjoys a little bit, I'm curious when it comes to writing, especially for a show where you know, the concept's already come up and you're saying, okay, I'm going to be coming in, I'm going to be part of the writer's room. Where does the creativity come for you? Or, I mean, do we dare say that it becomes the art of it? Or is it largely a craft procedure at that point when you get brought on later on?
Well, I think the difference between an amateur writer and a professional writer is obviously the amateur waits for inspiration, and mm-hmm. then when they're inspired, they write, and when they're not, they don't. And the professional, if only in that somebody gets paid to do it, you need to be able to, it needs to be ready for you when you're ready to work and make money. So right. you know, yeah, there. So what you learn to do is be able to access the inspirational part when it's necessary. So it's a thing that takes time over years to learn how to do, because there are certainly lots of times. I mean, I'm never, as my family knows, I'm never more miserable than when I'm writing for a week. I hate it.
Okay.
I really dislike the process of writing. Having written is nice, but actually having to sit down and you know, pull, nobody like. I don't know a lot of people who like it. Although obviously you keep doing it, and then they have these great moments. So when it comes to a TV show, what I like about it as well is that it's, I actually read a good quote from Matthew Weiner recently where he said, you know, TV is for writers who hate being alone more than they hate writing. And I think that's true. So I really like the process of sitting with a group of people and you spend 6 to 8 hours a day going, well, what if this happened? Well, what if that happened? And that's right. fun. And that's inspiring. And what I learned years ago was the trick to writing something as big as a movie or a TV series is you got to do it in bite-sized chunks. So the first thing you got to do is you do that. And then at the end of that, after you've broken a story and put up the plot points on a board, you know, you write up a page so that you can show that around. And then you do up an outline, which is, you know, 10 to 20 pages, and then you show that around. And then so that by the time you're sitting down to write a script, if inspiration hits you, great, and you're feeling great and you're able to write a brilliant scene, that's awesome, and that is your job, but you're also following by that point a pretty guided path.
Right.
And that is now, I mean, I also remember reading about David Milch saying, you know, who created Deadwood and NYPD Blue, who said outlines are a expression of despair. And as to him, he apparently legendarily writes his scenes on the day that they are shot, or keeps rewriting again and again until and never finishes. I just, that's not my process. My process is right. certainly more that you kind of, it's one step in front of the other. Hopefully by the time you, and then the process continues after you write it, and you hope that every stage makes it better. And there are a lot of stages.
Right. And is there a satisfaction that gets hit upon the realization of seeing it on the screen?
Almost
like, you know, the old band stories, but when you hear that record played on the radio for the first time.
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny. There's just a weird satisfaction of seeing your show broken up by commercials. To me, I always really, I mean, and I,
it becomes real, right?
I always fast forward past everybody else's shows commercials, but on mine, I always watch them because there's something that feels very real about that. Once you see it and you go, you know, there's my line, and it really is an intoxicating experience.
Wait, I want to do a meta-text reading of what commercials are being inserted after this.
Yeah, exactly.
Here.
Oh, it's really, it can be a lot of fun. It's really interesting.
So I also want to talk a little bit about some of the shows that you've been on as well. And maybe if you could give a couple of, any kind of, reflections or because over the past couple of years, some of the bigger shows that have been on television, including a show that I will admit now, I don't know if you've been listening, over the past few weeks, Greg David has been running a, greatest Canadian shows by decade
right.
poll on the TVA website. About 2 years ago, Diane and I did a very comprehensive kind of tournament style one, and Flashpoint won.
Yes, which was very gratifying. Believe me, we were all very happy to see that.
Now, it really pissed me off, not because I don't like Flashpoint, because it beat SCTV.
I understand. And you know what? I would agree with you. These That's the problem with these sorts of brackets. In the end, you're like, and it's ridiculous. I mean, on a fundamental level, you go like, and you know, I'm really glad that some people feel Flashpoint is at that level of SCTV. But even if you accept that premise, you can't compare the two.
Yes.
It's ludicrous. It's funny to say. And so, again, I'm glad we won. I mean, who doesn't want to win?
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, that's nuts. And how any of them beat Hilarious House of Frightenstein is beyond me even.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We'll have to make sure to mention that to Diane, who still doesn't believe the show exists, apparently.
Oh, absolutely. It was the greatest, craziest show of all time.
Yes. And I'm proud to be in Hamilton, where it was created.
So Hamilton has a very interesting history with Canadian TV, and has given us lots of great stuff. So
for sure, I mean, the independent studios at CHCH for years. A lot of the camera workers went out far and wide around the world from there because they had such great training.
So, but yeah, as far as early.
So how many years were you on Flashpoint?
I was around Flashpoint from the beginning to the end. I started on the first. I was on the first two seasons as a story editor. Then I went on to help them launch Rookie Blue when I was for season three. So I was off doing Rookie Blue for a couple seasons.
So another not so popular show.
So you know, I like to kind of move from these niche genre little nobody watch shows. I've been very lucky to work with, and that was, you know, because Tassie Cameron, who had helped launch, who's an EP on Flashpoint, kind of went over there and said, "Hey, do you want to help me launch this one?" And it was very different, and seemed like a great chance to do something very different. So that was a lot of fun. And then, season four, I wrote a couple of episodes. And it was great to kind of have a little break and cleanse my palate. But then once I was able to write for the show again, it reminded me how much I loved it. So when I returned in season five, it was as co-EP and as Mark and Stephanie's kind of second in command to help them guide the show. And I was really happy to be able to have started it and seen it through. And then to be able to kind of end it was on our own terms was a great experience and was an awesome experience. To work on a show, I hadn't done a huge amount of TV before, and so to work on a show which, you know, you had the, in Canada, unfortunately rare experience of being able to say to people when they ask what you work on, I work on a show, well, what show? Flashpoint. And they go, oh, I've seen that. I like that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, my mom loves that show. is actually a really gratifying experience to know that people are out there watching it. So, and same with Rookie Blue.
Yeah, for sure. Sometimes it would seem to me that people just hearing of the show is a great thing by itself. The fact that they've actually seen it and like it is a whole new level altogether.
We were also very lucky to have on both those shows, you know, real American presence as well, which certainly helped in the eyes of the world, I think, and just in terms of, you know, getting it out there and having people watch it. And then, you know, we did really well on CBS when it was on there, and Rookie Blue continues to be, you know, a great performer for ABC. So that's also really, really gratifying.
Right. Now, when you take on the roles on series like that of more of a macro role, and you're not necessarily just writing an episode or something like that, when you're looking at the big picture, how does that kind of change does it become, can you divorce yourself from it being essentially just a management task at that point? Fun all the same, and even like the teamwork aspect that you mentioned before that you had when you get together in the writer's room. But is there an element of the management side of it that that you love or you don't necessarily like?
So far in my experience, I mean, there's certainly days when certain things are easier than others. It's never fun to get notes unless all the notes are, this is the best script I've ever read. We're just lucky to have you here. anything less than that is miserable. But no, I mean, you know, it's a great train set, you know. You have to have a very particular, and look, not everybody loves the same things. You know, in my, I enjoy, it's weird to say, but I enjoy production meetings. Some writers hate them, you know, some are like, ugh, let's just get them. I enjoy them if they're going well. And if it's a bunch of people, you know, to me, I realized when I got into television, what I loved about it was that it was like, it's the world's greatest Dungeons and Dragons game. You know, literally everybody sitting around kind of making believe stuff together is
you're gonna make a saving throw against
exactly
producer
I would love to, you know, it would, and you do, right? You do find ways, absolutely, to see and you learn if you grew up playing D, is, you know, how that it is not just about one person. Even as a showrunner, like, the interesting thing about television is nobody's really in charge. I mean, there's people with different levels of authority and influence. Obviously, a showrunner has the most powerful in a story room, except that they're also bound by their responsibilities to their producers and to the network. And then the producer, then you're taking notes from them. The producers are bound to the network. The network would seem to be in charge, except, of course, they're bound to the audience's attention. So everybody is forced to kind of tell the best story they can tell. So I know we've gone a bit far from your question, but I think what I really have always loved about the entertainment industry and business is that, you know, it kind of keeps us all, to a certain degree, I think, honest, and that we all have to, you know, tell a story that is going to appeal to more than just us.
Yeah, what I love about podcasts is we're not bound to questions.
Fair enough. No, absolutely. And then there's that freedom as well. And, you know, believe me, all writers also, we all go, oh, and then I got my novel where I can do whatever I want to do, which, you know, we all do with varying degrees of success.
So I just want to jump back to what I'm going to be predicting is going to be an experience with Killjoys for you, in that there is no group of fans that mm-hmm. jump on the online bandwagon more than science fiction fans, it seems. And it seems like you are a pretty active person on Twitter.
Yeah.
Relatively?
Yes. Very. I would say I have kind of consciously stepped back recently. You know, it was interesting. It was a kind of an ongoing thing of seeing the tenor of discussion on Twitter in particular, but in the public space as well, and then also just wanting to take some time to think about what does it mean as a creator to be that engaged and that publicly engaged with people. So, and yes, I know I expect it'll obviously be Michelle and her current production team that will be weathering the most amount of attention. But Michelle is actually far less plugged in and engaged, and I think that will probably help her in a lot of ways.
Do you feel that there is a usefulness these days for either writers, actors, production team to jump into that level of engagement, or is it still let's let corporate do it?
No, I mean the thing is, when I started on Twitter, I mean, it had been around for, I guess, a couple of years, but I started on it when I was doing second season of Flashpoint, and I started on just to kind of, you know, check in with you know, friends and stuff, and then very quickly was being followed by Flashpoint fans, and it immediately became clear to me how powerful a tool it was for that kind of connection and engagement, and I really responded. I mean, the only time I've personally had a negative experience was when after I'd left Rookie Blue, they killed a beloved character, and all of a sudden my Twitter blew up with people being incredibly angry at me and everybody who'd ever worked on Rookie Blue for having killed her. And it was also an instructive moment, because you kind of realize that with that level of engagement comes to some people a certain level of entitlement. And and I think that's the part that I'm still trying to figure out, because I certainly don't think, I think if it just turns into another big marketing corporate exercise, who gives a shit? And I think, if anything, one of the great things about the explosion of blogs and podcasts is wrestling the entertainment press, which for far too long, and still to this day, is just a wing of PR. And right. I mean, what's been shocking is the number of fans who just still want it to only be a wing of PR, as opposed to, you know, something that's both critically engaged with it. So I love that. At the same time, what I look at, and what I guess gives me a bit of pause, is it's that entitlement. It's that, you know, I think, and, you know, as I'm kind of, you know, as a lot of us just trying to figure out what social media means and what it's doing, I definitely believe that art is it's a person or a group of people or a corporation or whoever putting out a story and expressing something. And then I think if you're lucky enough to have an audience who wishes to respond to it, that's great. But I don't think it follows. I think it can follow that the audience gets to dictate then back, well, here's what we demand. I mean, they can, right. And if you pander to that, then that's fine. But you're not. Then you are just literally doing fan service all the time. And I don't. I think we all know that doesn't actually last very long. So I think for me, the part that I start, and then as well, and we've certainly seen it in the genre space and the fans, and we saw like what happened, say, with Joss Whedon recently, is there's right. also another undercurrent that goes there, which is just a kind of a brutal level of discourse, which I used to, I once had a show of my own that was about kind of geek world. And I'll admit, you know, having grown up in comic book shops and in early online BBSs, there was a kind of viciousness that we all treated each other, which was funny because it seemed so innocuous. Right. You know, it was ranking, you know, in a sense on each other and what you liked. It's interesting to see how as that's kind of grown, and it just seems uglier and uglier to me. And that part makes me right. recoil a bit.
There's certainly a, for lack of a better phrase, there's a culture of meanness that happens when you can, even if it's your real name, you're essentially anonymous.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And I think, and it's interesting to me. It's human. So I'm certainly not, yeah. I'm not the person who goes, here's how you should all behave on Twitter. First and foremost, a writer and observer. So I go, this is what people are doing. But it occurred to me that it's hard to observe it when you're right in the middle of it and when you're trying to figure out how to respond in it. So I think it's an interesting time. I don't think I'm the only one. I've noticed, because I still look at my Twitter feed, and I've noticed a lot of creators, I think, are pulling back a bit. I think there was a time when we were like, let's plug in, let's engage, let's talk. And again, I have to say, my personal experience has been 90% positive. I'm still followed by people who were Flashpoint fans, who were Rookie Blue fans, who were Remedy fans, who are just lovely and wonderful. And it's not been, thankfully, my experience that those fans were anything other than gracious. And even if they didn't like something, behaved like adults. So, you know, I do wonder if it's still such a great idea for creators to be so constantly engaged with their audience, because, you know, ultimately how does this affect the work? Are you able, if you're constantly thinking, how is this going to play on Twitter? You're constantly thinking, we got to get 5 shake my head moments in the next 10 minutes or else it's not blowing up. I do wonder, well, then are we really writing something that's good, or are we just writing something is just kind of playing to a particular crowd?
Yeah. It almost sounds like anticipating notes that you might be getting as opposed
it is a danger of television writing. We all do it, and we've all talked with them in the room of, I can see this note, I can see that note. And you kind of always have to go, you know, the greatest showrunners I've had, like Tassie, like Mark and Stephanie, have always, like Michelle, have always stepped back, like Greg Spottiswood, and said, you know, okay, whatever the note is, what's true? Follow right. that, and we'll deal with what comes after. And that to me has always been the great thing. So I think it would be the same. You know, what's Twitter going to think about this? Well, what do we want to write? And then we'll deal with that after.
Right. So over the past year to year and a half or so, you've also done a couple of episodes for other shows. You mentioned Remedy. You did an episode for Murdoch Mysteries as well. Which walking into an establishment like that is, you know, there's a well-oiled machine there.
One of the best well-oiled machines. I mean, I was very, very lucky on that one. I had worked with Pete Mitchell, who's the showrunner, before, and so got along with him great. So he called.
And we had an episode with him on
Wonderful guy. And that one was also just, there was so much serendipity in that one. It was, the timing was great. But then they said, hey, how would you like to do a spy story with basically two of the characters who I always liked the most on the show anyway? And I had just literally read an article about John le Carré making Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and was like, oh, I love this space, I love this world. So I got to write, so I got to go in and pitch an episode that they were like, yeah, that sounds good. And it was a blast. It couldn't have been more fun. And there's a fantastic fan base as well.
for sure. Now, so with Killjoys, is when did the have all the? I'm assuming all the episodes.
Oh yeah,
have been
yeah,
shot
they've been
this
shot
point?
A while. They were shot a few months ago.
Okay. So you're kind of in you're in a holding pattern with Killjoys, but does that mean that you get to work on other stuff? Is there other stuff we should be looking for?
I am on season 2 of X Company as a co-executive producer, so that's why I'm off to Budapest this summer. I'll be working on that, and that's a great reunion to get to work with Mark and Stephanie again, and also just kind of scratch my itch for I love World War II stories, and as I just said before, I'm a huge spy buff, so. Getting to do all of that wrapped up is a lot of fun.
It was really cool because I really enjoyed the tone of X Company as I watched it this past year too. Because it could just be me getting older, but one of the first things I look for in a show now is tone.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
I don't care what it looks like. I don't care what I want. In other words, if you can hit me with the right tone. The right tone and the right characters, I don't care where it's set, I don't care what it's about, I will watch.
Well, and I mean, I think tone, I think another word we use for that is voice. You know, I think I totally agree, and it's, again, what I think as television has evolved. But I, probably from the get-go, you could say that, if you can tell the shows that had a strong creative focus or somebody at the center who was really guiding that voice. And that's where the tone comes from, and it's a person being able to say, to put the voice they hear in their head onto the page and then get it through the gauntlet of production so that once it gets to the screen, it's there. But I totally agree. That is, there's such a fundamental thing.
So, being, on my mother's side, I'm Hungarian, so you get to go to Budapest.
Fantastic.
Now, are you going to be bringing your oxygen masks with you? I've heard it's one of the most polluted cities in...
Oh, see, I haven't heard that. Nobody tells me these things. They just tell me it's great and I can drink Palinka and...
Like, I've heard it's lovely, but I've heard that in the morning it's... Now, it could have changed. This was maybe about 10 to 15 years ago,
well,
but apparently when the wall fell, so to speak, and the Iron Curtain came down, they weren't too big on... They were too big on pollution controls.
Oh, good Lord. All right. Well, I don't... Yeah, the writers certainly have given me some suggestion. The big ones being bring peanut butter and salad. They said those are the two things you won't be able to get. So
all in
I'll
one
just
bowl.
Have to load
just
up my peanut
and
butter
salad.
And salad, I guess. But other than that, I'm really looking forward to it. And getting to also bring my family over is going to be pretty great. So, and you can't really shoot a World War II story in Canada. At least you can't shoot a World War II story set in Europe, in Canada. It doesn't quite work.
Although I think that I'm waiting for the day that there's a mini series about St. Pierre and Miquelon during World War II, because I think that would make a great story.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think Bomb Girls was a great example also of, there are great home front stories and there are great stories to be told. So, I mean, what's funny to me is I live in Whitby, and so I am literally about 5-minute drive from the Camp X site. I can go walk it right now and take pieces from it, and so when I was showing the show to my kids and they said then there are sections that are set in Camp X and they go, oh my gosh, that's just over there, and I'm like, no, that's in Budapest. That's television. That's right, we flew all the way over to Budapest to shoot Whitby.
the lingering memory I have as a child of Whitby. And I apologize if this sounds like I'm reducing
that's
it down.
All right.
But
I'm not a born Whitbyite, so you will not offend me.
Okay. There used to be, and I don't know if there still is, a quite legendary go-kart track in Whitby.
I think I know what you're talking about, and I think it is gone. I'm pretty sure it is gone. But this is definitely go-kart country. Yes, this is an area where that would have been the thing to do. A Saturday night, and then I suppose it's that or the roller rink, I guess. But we don't... no longer with us. So,
The last thing that I like to talk to everybody about is I like to reach back to the pop cultural touchstones of youth and try and siphon from you some of the things that you've carried with you to this day. Because for me, it was the 70s Saturday morning.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was so I'm 40 now, so it was a little 80s. Saturday morning Supercade was probably where I was really like, early 80s was when it was the big one for me. And I still get a certain tingle when I see like the when I'm trolling through YouTube and discover, like, you know, the credit sequence for Thundar the Barbarian. That one still absolutely gets me. And
Ookla the Mock.
Yeah. Oh, come on. He had a laser sword. It was the best.
He had a laser sword and he had one line of dialogue, which
So good. So good. So yeah, I loved, so certainly as a child growing up, yes, the cartoons were big. I honestly, hilarious House of Frightenstein and You Can't Do That on Television, were two very, very big ones. And then later on, I mean, I was, again, always kind of a genre geeky kid. So comic books were a big one. And I would say, as a writer, I would actually say, you know, I was lucky enough to grow up and really be into comics in the summer or the year that Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns came out. And those were really still, to this day, pretty seminal pop culture experiences. I still think of what I learned about writing from Watchmen and what I learned about imagery and just storytelling from Dark Knight Returns.
I have owned probably about six different copies of the trade paperback of Watchmen over the course of my life, because I wear them out too. And I loan them to people. I just give them away. I say, you have to read this. But the truly underappreciated talent out of Watchmen was Dave Gibbons. Yes. His artwork, he laid out every single page like it was a painting.
No, it was, and I mean, again, I'm a big fan of going and reading how they made stuff, and it's hilarious to read how, you know, towards the end of that show, the run of that comic, because they had to keep to their, you know, one a month schedule, you know, Moore was faxing page by page the script to Gibbons, who had his children doing the panels, because, of course, the rule on that comic was they were doing the nine panels or the 3x3 grid. And so his kids would end up having to do the grids for him while he strategically drew it. And then you look at it and every frame is a masterpiece. And I remember actually I'd read it. I loved it. And, two or three years after it had come out, I was reading a Comics Journal review and they pointed out something I hadn't even noticed, but it always stuck with me. There's no sound effects in it. There's no sound, there's no pow and crash. And I went and I rushed back and I realized it's true. And it really, really struck me that, wow, you know, like you can, and I didn't notice, you know, because in a sense I could already hear it because the images were so strong.
So everybody needs to go watch Killjoys. If you're listening to this podcast, and here's what I like to do. I'm going to call out, I don't even know, just random people. We're going to freak people out here because they're going to have earbuds in somewhere. We're going to go, so Dave, Mary, Stuart, you need to go watch right now.
Very good.
If you have any it's like Romper Room. If you have a few names you want to throw out, just throw them out. And likely there's someone listening.
Romper Room was another one that was very deep in, but that was because I remember there was literally the day when she called out Adam, said Adam would be there, and I waited all week. I was like, I'm going on Romper Room. And I didn't even, it was like four, so I figured it'll just happen. And then that day came, and she's like, introduced some kid who was clearly not Adam. And that's when I knew that television was a lie. And I would.
It's like this is bullshit.
That's when my plot to destroy it from the inside began, and I will have my revenge on Romper Room one day.
Well, thanks to Adam Barkin for talking with me on the TV ABC's podcast this week. You can find all of the episodes that we record at tv-eh.com. And if you look at the top, there's a little link there called podcast. You click on there, you'll not only get the TV ABC's podcast, but you'll get the podcast that we record every other week talking about television news with myself, Greg David, and Diane Wild. We sometimes have great news to talk about. Sometimes we have to stretch it out a little bit, but we always have a great discussion on Canadian television when not enough people are doing that these days. And by the way, if you go there and you like that and you like this podcast, well, you might also want to go to our Patreon page, which is just a place where if you want to kick in a couple of bucks to help keep the servers running and the air conditioning going during the summer, you can do that by going to patreon.com/TV_EH. And that would be great. You can always listen to the podcast for free, but if you want to go there, we would certainly appreciate it. And also, you can find me on Twitter at Anthony Marco and all the other podcasts that I do at anthonymarco.com. You can find the podcast, like I said, at tv-eh.com, but you can find us on Twitter at tv_EH. So hopefully you can get in touch with us in one of those places and let us know what you think about this show as well. That wraps up another episode for this week. And now back to your regularly scheduled programming.